This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
This is the Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Muck. People say that money makes the world go round, but do we know really how true that is? Does the money that everyone sees in deal announcements and mega project investments and public listings, and then there's the money we don't that resides in offshore accounts around the world. Tom Burgess, investigations correspondent for the Financial Times and author of Kleptopia, How Dirty Money's Conquering the World, looks at just this. And in his book, he tracked what the Financial Times called arguably one of the biggest heists in modern history. And he's come on the show to talk to us about it. Tom, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
It's an absolute pleasure to join you.
So the first thing that I wanted to touch on is that I was very surprised to notice that your book is written in the style of almost a thriller. You start off with a cast of characters. The narrative is very much in a storytelling fashion. What made you make this stylistic choice? You ultimately also received some criticism saying that the breadth and depth of your research perhaps made the narrative a little bit difficult to follow.
Yes. All of those things are true. When I was digging deeper and deeper into this world of dirty money, I thought two things. One, I thought that a lot of times what happens when people try to explain this world or penetrate it and write about it is that they get entangled in a world of front companies and offshore trusts and dummy directors and all sorts of financial chicanery that is meant to confuse and bewilder us and meant to obscure the human agency in this stark world. And so as I was reporting the book over 5 years, and tried to understand the psychology of what it is to be a kleptocrat, to live in a world of corruption. And I thought that to write the book through some of those characters from that world would be the best way of really understanding how this hidden power works. So I told the story through kind of troublemaking British banker, an idealist Canadian lawyer, a mafia-connected Russian-born dealmaker from Brooklyn, and an oligarch from the former Soviet Union. And the model for this kind of book, this kind of non-fiction novel, the pinnacle of this genre is probably the first book ever written in it, which is from 1966. It's In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Now, I fear I have to admit that a reader of Kleptopia may feel that I haven't quite hit the heights that Capote, one of the, you know, the great novelists of his generation, managed to hit. But I do think, and some of those reviewing the book have been kind enough to agree that the book is a non-fiction novel. It's written in the style of a thriller, and the characters that carry you through, I'm nowhere to be found in the book. And I hope that it keeps you turning the pages. Yes, it's a difficult and dense world, and there's a cast of characters to help you navigate that large world. But I hope it's the kind of book one might read as we read, say, the Wolf Hall trilogy, a world of hidden power with all sorts of characters. Ultimately, what we just see is a form of power that shapes all our lives laid bare.
Theft on the kind of scale that you describe that makes billionaires, this doesn't happen in a vacuum. And you talk a little bit about, you know, the atmosphere after the fall of the Soviet Union that led to the rise of some of your main cast of characters. But ultimately, I mean, what would you say are some of the contributing factors that you found led to this world of kleptopia, as you call it, you know, the transacting of dirty money, not just in back alleys, but in some of the gilded staterooms and the highest offices in the land?
Good question. So what do I mean by kleptopia? It's pretty simple, really. I mean a world in which corruption is becoming the dominant form of power. So in a democracy or in a free society, what we hope happens is that those entrusted with power are entrusted to use it, broadly speaking, to steward the common good, and they can be held to account for their decisions, and they don't have conflict of interest that might lead them to act against the common good and for narrow private interests. A kleptocratic system is one where that's turned on its head, where power is wielded for the benefit of those who hold that power. That's ultimately what we mean by corruption, the diversion of wealth, resources, and power from the collective, from the commonwealth, to private interests. And I fear now, if you look around the world, I was a correspondent in South America, then I was a correspondent in various parts of Africa for several years, and then I've been working on the Financial Times investigations team for quite a while now, and that's included a lot of work on China and the former Soviet Union. And I fear that if you look at a map like the one that I have here tacked up on my wall, and you go country by country, you'll see that most of the world and a large majority of the global population are governed by kleptocracies. Mm. That's a terrifying reality. But it's also true that the breakdown doesn't work really country by country. What's happening is that networks that don't respect national borders, kleptocratic networks bent on, if you like, the privatization of power itself, they span the world. They've become globalized. You're right to mention the fall of the Soviet Union. That was a huge engine of this, when the wealth of an empire was snatched by a connected few, politicians, opportunists, security types, and gangsters. That was an enormous engine of this. But throughout the Cold War and throughout history, autocratic regimes have come to power. What's happened now is that they're connecting internationally. And that means also connecting with banks, connecting with law firms, connecting with bankers and lawyers within those firms, connecting with former politicians in the West, in the rich democracies that rent out legitimacy effectively to these kleptocratic networks. And I mean, the 1MDB scandal in Malaysia is an extraordinary example of this. It's one I touch on only briefly in the book. There are different examples in the book, but nonetheless, what happened with 1MDB, and we're still understanding the full scale of it, but that is a truly globalized kleptocratic network, because what these networks have to have is hold on state power in some places. That's what you need to divert what belongs to us all to narrow, powerful interests. But then in order to move that money globally, you need the assistance of big banks, Goldman Sachs, in the case of 1MDB. And you need a whole coterie of lobbyists and politicians to across the world to collaborate in your endeavor so that they can make, so that the people in these kleptocratic networks, they can do the key thing to perpetuate their power, which is to make that illegitimate, corrupt power they hold, to make it seem legitimate and to hijack the institutions of legitimate power, whether that be elections or private sector or the courts or any of the other institutions that are supposed to protect us.
So I guess that does play into my next question very well, because your book does illustrate the snowball effect of small decisions that fall into the lap of, you know, the individual private bankers to the larger institutions, kind of going up the ladder to ultimately funnel money into the pockets of corrupt state actors. It feels very much like, for example, in the 1MDB scandal, that if the big figureheads, if we prosecute them, if we put them in jail, you know, that it's all gone. It can be swept under the rug. But is that actually the case? I mean, the US as well, where we've seen President Donald Trump go out of power, and it feels like everyone is hankering for a reset with the Biden administration in place. But is that reset just a fiction?
It's a fascinating question, isn't it? And I think it's one of the, I think if you sit at long enough with this question, you realize it's one of the most urgent ones of our times, because we're essentially talking about whether the rule of law can survive, aren't we? That's really what we're talking about. And whether it can survive the spread of corruption, of transnational corruption. So, you know, the 1MDB case in Malaysia, the legal consequences of that, the Najib trial and so on, and the American prosecutions that have come out of that case, these are all important ones to watch. The prosecution or otherwise of Donald Trump in the States, especially as it relates to the corruption of power. These are going to be crucial to watch. But what's troubling, if we try to answer this question, what's really troubling is that more and more we see, as kleptocracy takes hold internationally, we see what's described as anti-corruption campaigns mm-hmm. being used as tools of the corrupt. So they are used as ways for one faction within a corrupt political system to destroy another faction within a corrupt political system. Obviously, that is not going to make that political system more corrupt. It's just going to elevate one faction over another. So you might look at Mohammed bin Salman's so-called anti-corruption campaign in Saudi Arabia. Anyone who thinks that that has removed corruption from the Saudi regime is on the wrong planet. We could look at some of the prosecutions of Putin's enemies on corruption charges. We could look at an extraordinary case that I followed through the book, the case of Mukhtar Ablyazov, a man who, yes, grew very rich in a very corrupt kleptocratic system, but then was pursued through the Western legal system by the Kazakh dictatorship after he challenged the Kazakh dictator politically. We could look at Xi Jinping's anti-corruption campaign in China. Is that, to what extent is that an anti-corruption campaign? Partly it seems to be, but partly it certainly seems to be a way for him to cement himself as the most powerful Chinese ruler since Mao. And now what we see as well is more and more that the West, the Western democracies, the rich democracies, they're trying to pull levers that exert pressure on kleptocratic systems. So sanctions, the new global Magnitsky tools, these can all be valuable. And they I guess even if they're flawed, it's better to have some tools than none. But the danger is that you're just picking sides in kleptocratic power struggles. I guess the real antidote to this is true rule of law, true judicial independence. So the question for the Biden administration, one would hope, would be that this isn't a question for the Biden administration. It's a question for the American legal system that's independent from politics, you might hope. Similarly, in Malaysia, the greatest legacy you could imagine from the 1MDB scandal would be to reinforce judicial independence. It looked, in the great Lava Jato, the great car wash scandal in Brazil, it looked as though the judiciary was really standing up for itself. And now, in the later stages of that extraordinary scandal, it appears that parts of the judiciary have been less independent than one might have hoped. But this is always the struggle. It always has been. And it's just getting more difficult because kleptocracy is strengthening itself by globalizing. The struggle is for it to have genuine independent institutions of the rule of law.
I'm speaking with Tom Burgess, investigations correspondent for the Financial Times and author of Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. Stay tuned for more conversations. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Tom Burgess, investigations correspondent for the Financial Times, as well as author of the book Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. So when it comes to the question of how we can stop the flow of dirty money around the world, you prescribe at the end of the book honesty, as these kinds of activities thrive in darkness and secrecy, but is that perhaps a little bit also too idealistic to hope for? I mean, you also described the many dire consequences that befall those who attempt this kinds of honesty and integrity, you know, disappearances, torture, destitution. How do we give that honesty and transparency the strength of institutional backing?
By fighting for it. This book began when I was doing like an event, a talk about my previous book. It's called The Looting Machine, about the oil and mining industries in Africa and the corruption and conflict that they beget there. And there's a club in London called the Frontline Club. That it's for war correspondents, and they do events there. And a couple of others did a talk about corruption and chewed it over. And a guy at the back put his hand up to ask a question, and he was pretty much bald. He had glasses on, and as I remember it, sort of frilly shirt. And he said, he was English, and he said, I used to work at a Swiss bank, actually, and I can tell you there was definitely a lot of corruption going on there. I thought that's pretty extraordinary. That's not necessarily the kind of question or comment you get at a public event. So anyway, got talking to this chap at the bar afterwards. Nigel Wilkins was his name. 5 years later, he would be the really the central character in Kleptopia. He's the everyman in this book. This could be any one of us who finds ourselves in a situation where we're going about our lives and our jobs. But then suddenly the fates conspire and it falls to us to decide whether we're going to stand up to this, as you rightly say, terrifying force of global kleptocracy. And it fell to Nigel, and I won't give away the story for anyone who might wish to go and read it for themselves, but Nigel suffered for his, you're right to say, but I think I can say with total confidence that Nigel, given his time again, would have done what he did. He would have stood up for what he knew to be right, and he would have said that this growing tide of dirty money and of the whole apparatus of propaganda and fake news that goes with it to try to disguise this great coup, essentially, this great seizure of power around the world. I feel I know for a fact that Nigel, given the chance 100 times, he would have found the courage to do what he did and try to expose it.
This also raises a bit of a question on the strength of our institutions in general in this day and age, because you talk about how deeply intertwined so many of these corrupt elements are with what would, on the face of it, seem to be upstanding elements of our financial institutions, our government systems. So if we take that away, can our major financial institutions still survive, or is there a reckoning that needs to happen?
Well, this, you know, we're touching on two things there, aren't we? The regulators mm-hmm. and the financial system itself. And I think what may lie close to the heart of this problem is decades now where we've had in our discussions of these questions, there's been a kind of market fundamentalism, an idea whereby the market will solve everything. And that was a useful political idea for the West during the Cold War, to give a sort of moral value to the market, to say, you know, economic freedom, the freedom to make profits, that is the force that is going to defeat the evil of communism, and off we go. And then that market fundamentalism became the drive for privatization around the world and for this, essentially the denigration of the state and the idea that the state is bad for us and should be cut down to the basic level. I think that proceeded through the greatest change we've seen, the switch of this former Soviet Union to something that we called capitalism. Mm-hmm. And we now discover there was no such thing. It's a gangster state that has put on the clothes of the market, but it's actually just a deeply corrupt and violent dictatorship. And that has happened all over the world, is that corrupt regimes have used the kind of the vocabulary of the market to allow themselves to plug into the global economy. And somehow we can all turn a blind eye to the reality of this. But the financial regulators in the City of London, where Nigel Wilkins work, that is an extraordinary example of regulators that see themselves, in some cases, as Nigel Wilkins describes in the book, that see themselves as the servants of the industry, not the watchdogs. You're right to pick up on institutions and the way they've been hollowed out, compromised, and made complicit in the excesses of the market, really. I would agree that this is a central question. We need more Nigel Wilkins, essentially. We need more people who see the value, the courageous work that's to be done in regulation. We might have to give it a different name, but in policing or working as a watchdog to safeguard the common good against narrow interests.
Mm. It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, though, isn't it? Because in a lot of cases, you see amongst the general public a loss of faith in the integrity of fiduciary and regulatory institutions, feeding into the perception of these institutions and the power that they have to enforce regulations upon industry. So how do we go about reversing that sort of sentiment?
It's another very good question. Yes, I think that lack of faith in the institutions, that faith has massively declined for various reasons, including, you know, the overly cozy relationships often between the people who run regulatory institutions and the people they're supposed to regulate. You know, the relationship, let's say, between the big four audit firms and the companies they're supposed to audit, there are huge problems with that. The relationships between financial regulators, between government economic departments and the big banks. How to revive that sense of public confidence in those regulations is, I think a starting point would be, look what's happening in the UK at the moment. This may seem arcane, but it's important, with fire regulations, the regulations of how you stop buildings catching fire. Now, those changes are happening in the UK because of the Grenfell Tower disaster. A building full of some of the poorer residents of London caught fire, and that building had been so shoddily built that it turned into a terrible death trap. Now, the inquiry is still going. It's to try to apportion responsibility for what happened there. But I think it's pretty clear that regulation was watered down to a ludicrous degree. Agencies were captive or subservient to the building industry. Now, part of the reason to write Kleptopia for me and to write The Looting Machine before that was to try and show that something similar is happening with dirty money and the way we police money. It's often seen as a crime, the main consequences of which is that some guy who doesn't deserve it has got a yacht, or you know, some guy's being able to send his children to an expensive school when really shouldn't be able to because his money was made in a dubious way, in a privatization or a dodgy deal or whatever it may be. But at the very center of the book is the story of Rosa Tulatieva in Kazakhstan, a woman who was tortured and saw her friends murdered in the most horrendous way, simply for trying to stand up for some absolutely basic entitlements. These are the victims. You know, we're looking around the world now. We see more and more people, bankers, lawyers, bystanders, if you like, turning up dead in relation to corruption cases, in relation to political battles with kleptocratic dictators from especially the former Soviet Union. These are the victims. So I think this shift, it's ultimately a shift of political will. I think it'll happen when we start to realize that the dirty money system is reaching into our lives now, whether it be in Malaysia or London or Zimbabwe or Moscow, and it can destroy those lives. And I think when we're starting to think about rebuilding institutions, we have to go down to these deep levels of talking about what our societies are becoming and how we express what we want as society through our watchdogs, through our legal systems, how we protect their independence. I think we have to go down to these questions of life and death and start to build up from there.
Thank you very much for speaking with us this morning, Tom. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Tom Verges, investigations correspondent for the Financial Times, as well as author of the book Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.